This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn to graduate.
Good day, everyone. Hope everyone is having a wonderful day. Alex, how are you doing today?
Doing great. I've got my my daughter here. I'm on dad duty today. So we're really excited for this Her first podcast experience.
That's great. And also, she's wearing a Stata onesie, so she's super cute. I love it.
Yeah, I need to get an R onesie.
That's right. Oh, gosh. And an R versus Stata onesie, right?
Like, oh, that'd be great. Yeah. How are you doing, Sebastian?
I'm good. I'm good. It's Friday, so I am feeling good. Have a couple of things to do today, but it's mostly meeting. Fridays are usually my meeting day. I don't know if this is a tip, but I'll put a lot of my meetings on Friday because my brain is like, I don't know if I want to do work. So I usually like talking to people on Fridays. That's my go-to. Great. So today we're talking to Anne Burton. Anne is a job market candidate this year, so pay attention to her. Especially today. She's a PhD student in economics at the economics department at Cornell University. Her research is primarily concerned with the social welfare implications of risky health behaviors and crime. She's also the co-founder of the group Diversity in Cornell Economics. We're very excited to have her. And thank you for joining us today. Can you share a fun fact about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here today. A fun fact about myself is that I like to run Tough Mudders.
Oh, okay. How long are those?
Usually around 10 miles.
Oh, wow.
But you don't have to run the whole way.
Do you do stuff in between? Like what?
Yeah, it's a 10 mile like mud run obstacle course. So like sometimes you'll jump off a like 30 foot height into the water or like, you know, there's like rope climbing stuff and they always have the dumpster full of ice water that you have to jump into.
Oh, wow.
Like completely submerging.
And do you do this because at the end you feel like super, super human basically? Or
usually at the end I feel very tired. but no, I run them with one of my friends who is a law enforcement officer at the Federal Reserve where I used to work before grad school. So we run them together every year. And he's like amazing. He used to be a Marine. So like usually I've kind of got the edge on the running, but he definitely has the edge on all the obstacles. Like he can go through the monkey bars in like 3 seconds.
That's crazy.
I feel like we should do one of these at the next in-person AEAs and call it the job market.
Oh, gosh. Too real.
I would like that.
Every time the job market comes, I always refer it as like the quarter quail job market games.
Yeah. You'll have to run with your suit up a staircase and then like it's like a biathlon where you have to then center your breath and calm your heart.
That's funny.
Well, all right, Anne, we're really looking forward to talking with you today. But before we get into our topic of the day, can we hear a little bit about your job market pitch?
Sure. Like Sebastian mentioned, my research agenda is focused on the social welfare implications of risky health behaviors and crime. So what that means is that my research focuses on topics in health economics, public economics, and the economics of crime. My job market paper specifically is about the impact of smoking bans in bars and restaurants on alcohol consumption, smoking, and alcohol-related crime. And how I extend the previous literature is by including city and county-level smoking bans. So previous work has looked at the impact of statewide smoking bans on related outcomes, but a lot of these laws were passed at the local level. And so that generates a lot of spatial heterogeneity.
Yeah, I'm really curious about this. So I lived in Ohio, and I'm sure lots of people lived through these passing, but Do you think it did it just like reshuffle where people consumed alcohol, like not in a bar anymore, but in a house? Or if you're on the border, like did people drive to Kentucky or something? I think that's what happened in Ohio, at least anecdotally.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's a kind of big motivation for accounting for these more local laws, is to account for like people, you know, driving across the state, or if say like the city that you're in passes a smoking ban, but the neighboring city doesn't, then you can just drive 20 minutes to go smoke and drink in that bar. So what I find is that alcohol consumption increases by a little bit. So among people who drink, it increases by about one drink per month, which isn't a whole lot. But that
is that among people who drink and smoke or just drink?
Just drink.
Okay.
So that could be pretty big if it's driven by smokers.
Yeah. So I break it down into like, you know, frequent and occasional smokers and then never and former smokers. And for occasional smokers, I think that's around 2 more drinks per month. And then for former smokers, it's around like 1.5 drinks per month. But these increases are concentrated entirely at bars and restaurants. So I either find no effect or small declines in alcohol consumed at home. And then I find a precisely estimated null effect on smoking. So at least in this time period, I'm studying 2004 to 2012. These bans don't appear to be inducing people to quit smoking. Then you might not be surprised given the kind of small impact on alcohol consumption. But as of right now, at least in preliminary results, I find that I can't reject the null hypothesis of no effect on alcohol related crime.
That's really interesting stuff. And I wonder if like this will have like big effects for like the kids of people that were smokers. Like now you're just like exposed to smoke a lot less when you're like a child in restaurants and things, like both from a health perspective, but also just like how acceptable is it to smoke, et cetera.
Yeah. So actually Ada and Cornaglia, I hope I'm pronouncing their names right. They have a paper kind of related to this. I think it's in the AEJ from maybe like 10 years ago. But they look at what happens to like the location of smoking for smokers after these bans are passed. And they find that, you know, unsurprisingly, smokers aren't smoking as much in bars and restaurants, but that they are smoking a lot more at home. And so for the children of smokers, that can actually kind of be worse, because then they're like in the home with their parents when they're smoking. And so they're being more exposed to it.
So then to summarize, they put smoking bans in places. People are now in these places having a couple more drinks. And then they're shifting, they're smoking presumably either at home or somewhere else. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So people aren't deciding whether to start or stop smoking as a result of these bans. It's definitely possible. And hopefully in one of my data sets, I'll be able to try to address this question of whether they're changing how much they smoke. Because it could be that, you know, they're smoking a few fewer cigarettes every day or every time that they go out to the bar because they're not smoking while they're drinking.
Well, thank you for sharing your research with us. Before we dive to the topic of the day, I actually want to ask Anne two questions, because I feel like she's created two interesting resources for the econ profession. One, you created this like conference calendar with Barton Village. And second, tell us a little bit about this Diversity in Cornell Economics Initiative.
Yeah, sure. So the conference spreadsheet that Barton and I created, which is available on both of our websites, if you are interested and want to see what that's about, or you know, look up conference deadlines and things like that. It was actually originally Barton's idea. So he used to make this for us in grad school, and he would pass it around to the other grad students. Yeah, in the policy analysis and management department. And then after he graduated, I reached out to him and I said, hey, I remember you making this conference spreadsheet. You know, would you be interested in updating this and maybe sharing it with everybody else? It's such a great resource. Mm-hmm. So he said, yeah, that's a great idea. So we did that.
How often do you update it?
We update it once every few months. And then if we see something on Twitter about a conference, then we'll go in and add that.
And right now they're only physical conference, or you added the virtual ones?
No. Yeah. We've added the virtual conferences.
Oh, awesome.
Pretty much everything is moving to virtual right now. So we have a column that has a status update. So it'll say like canceled or online or postponed.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it's really just a compilation of all these economics related conferences that we could find with their, you know, deadlines for submission, whether they require like an abstract or a paper, and the conference date and location, and then a website like with the call for papers or just for more information about the
conference. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you for doing that. That's awesome. And thank you for part in too. What about the diversity in Cornell initiative?
Yeah. So that was founded by a group of grad students this past fall. So previously, like over the last several years, a smaller group of us had been organizing these like women in economics events, both like informal chats and also like I spearheaded like women and sexism in economics a few years ago with faculty and grad students. And then a group of us organized the Speaking Economics Symposium last summer. And so that was about, you know, kind of how to bridge like cultural, racial, gender divides in economics and, you know, try to make economics more inclusive and welcoming. And then after that event, you know, we just decided that we kind of wanted to formalize our efforts and hopefully make it easier for people to keep organizing events like these.
So is it like you guys put events together, like seminars and social stuff as well? Like, is that kind of like the flavor of the organization?
Yeah. So it started out as more oriented towards graduate students. But in the last year, we've moved our focus to undergraduate outreach, especially.
Oh, awesome.
So like hosting info sessions for the AEA summer program, which is a great program for undergrads.
I'm an alumni of that program.
As well as, you know, trying to inform students about like the Sadie Collective. They have a
super important.
Every year. And so I think what we're trying to do for this next year is this like kind of 3-minute thesis event. So have a bunch
for undergrads.
Yeah. So it would be like grad students or faculty kind of talking about their research to undergrads, just so that undergrads can kind of learn about the wide variety of research that economists do, because they might not get exposure to that in their intro classes. As well as kind of having some like office hour type environments virtually, so that if students want to learn more about grad school or have questions about, you know, how to apply or what they should be doing in the years leading up to applying, they can just kind of drop in and ask their questions.
That's amazing. I think that synchronous communication is so valuable. Mm-hmm. And then encouraging people to participate is really great. I do have a question. How do you get prospective students, or like, how do you reach your target market? Like, that's good question. Like, I don't even know if students sometimes know that they're prospective students, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great question. So we like to advertise our AEA summer program info session. We emailed the instructors for like intro and intermediate, micro, and macro, and asked them to share it with their class. And then our department chair, Mike, also has a list of, I think, like all of the majors. And so we can just email stuff to him and he can send it out to all of the undergraduate majors, which of course isn't perfect because that doesn't capture all the people who might be interested in economics but aren't majoring in it yet.
Right. that makes sense.
That's how we usually try to approach them through classes. And then we should probably ask, we have an undergraduate member. So we should ask him like what he thinks are effective ways to reach out to more undergrads.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for that information initiative. I'm sure if they go to their website, they can find more information about it. But let's switch gears. And now, and you get to ask us a question about anything, professional development or anything like that. What's your question of the day for us?
Yeah, so I was interested in knowing what tips you have to stay connected and how to take advantage of like professional development opportunities, both now and in more regular times, which hopefully we'll be returning to at some point.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And there's, I feel like a lot of things that I was thinking about saying in this aspect. And by no means these are like an extensive and complete list. I'm sure there's other tips. So if people do have them, you know, share them on Twitter and so on. I think I'm going to mention maybe like a couple of like obvious ones, just so like we set the stage. I think in terms of keeping connected, you know, there's a lot of the virtual conferences that have been popping up. And I think those are really good places for students, because they're open for grad students, or also like anyone to come in and at least see papers. You know, there's sometimes I go and I log in and, you know, I can chat with some people while there's a presentation or ask questions. And that's a way that I keep like, hey, it was nice seeing you there, even though that's the only way I can see you. So I think that's like, that's one. I also encourage people to engage with the paper and the presentation, not only during the session, but like also offline. So, well, not offline, but afterwards. So, you know, if there's a paper that I found, it was really interesting and I have like a comment or a suggestion, I would email the author and be like, hey, I really love your paper. I have this idea or I have this comment. And I think that just like, it's, I think I used to do that before, but now I'm more conscious of it because it is the only way that I, you know, we can keep a relationship with this person that I've never met.
Yeah. And that can be really scary to do as a new student. And even currently, you know, sometimes depending on like, if there's like a power asymmetry between like the speaker and yourself, but definitely do it. Right. I think it's mm-hmm. like, as a person, I've given talks before and had grad students come up to me and be like, hey, I had this like list of questions. And some of them are like, I can answer immediately. And right. like, maybe they would have thought of as dumb questions, but I don't feel that way at all. But most of the time, it's not the case. They're great questions and they're new perspectives for things. So people really appreciate that. Even if it seems like it's an obvious sort of comment.
Yeah, and I think one thing that is important to remember is that some people think that this is like a way of getting your name out there or something like that. And I like to think about like networking and keeping connected as the main goal is just to build relationships with people that you want to build relationships with. And sometimes you need to come to that relationship offering something like a comment or a question or an idea. And that's I think the approach that I think is like, here's what I bring to this relationship. And, you know, obviously it won't develop as naturally as it may in a conference, but that's I think the mindset, which is like building, you know, relationships. And I feel like when I was a student, I did a lot with people from my cohort that now are in like, you know, positions of power. And it's great because, you know, that's the network that I came from. So,
yeah, no, that's a really great comment to think about. And I just want to sort of stress, like, you made a comment there, like building relationships with people I want relationships with. You might not necessarily know, like there's not some grand mm-hmm. strategy, but you might just have like been watching a paper or talking with someone and you're like, oh, I have this like thought. And then right. you'd be surprised what can develop after that. So like, let serendipity happen too there.
Yeah. As your I try to build relationships with people who I think they're cool because I'm like, you seem fun. I want to be your friend. I think the other, kind of like switching gears, the other thing that I would say that maybe it's less obvious is, you can create also your own little bubble of network and connectedness. So I thought I was unique in this, but then I found out that a lot of people are doing this, especially during this time, which is create like small Slack communities, or Slack is a messaging app. So you can do it in any app that you want. And for example, I have one where I ask people about coding issues. And there's another one where we, you know, talk about maybe empowerment and like feeling good. So you can do it with the set of grad school friends, maybe that across from your school or different schools. So you can create your, you know, your own different bubbles where you feel comfortable asking questions or making comments that maybe you wouldn't feel in the open. So that's, I feel, that's been a really nice way of keeping connected. Let's say I'm on a set of people and again, building that those relationships. There's also another obvious one is like Twitter. There's obviously benefit and cost when it comes with Twitter. So I won't go into depth with that, but I feel like that's a way of keeping yourself connected. And I think one last thing here is that sometimes all of this feels overwhelming. And And you feel like, not only I have to, you know, get ready for my TA and work on my paper and like have this thing ready for my advisor, I also have to do this whole thing of like networking. And to, and if you have that feeling, then don't, you know, stress about it too much. Like, don't overdo it. Just because you're, you know, out there and getting super connected doesn't mean, you know, they can have some positive things, but there's obviously an optimal level. And for each person, it involves different cost levels. So just try to keep a healthy balance of it.
Yeah. And like, I think Sebastian and I are both pretty similar in this, where we enjoy talking to people mm-hmm. and it is like cathartic to me to have these conversations, but not everyone feels that way. So like, don't feel like just because the optimal way to network for like me is to like have a conversation with somebody right after their presentation, that it's not absolutely perfect for you. If you're like, I'm not saying you, Anne, but like just the royals,
yeah.
you. It's like, send someone an email. All right. Or be a little more like, like, you know, like it could be different for everyone, and that's totally fine.
Yeah. Some people maybe also be tired of like, I mean, they have done like Zoom happy hours and all of that. There's another app that I recently heard of is called Gather.town, which is essentially a virtual living room where you can like go up to somebody and have a private conversation, even though there's like 15 people in the room. So that's kind of like simulating this whole like living room idea. I don't know. That's just like another thing to think about and use.
So Sebastian just outlined some really good, like not necessarily only COVID times related tips, but sort of online related tips and what you could do if you're not going to a number of conferences. But obviously, you know, COVID's not, well, hopefully COVID's not going to last for forever. Obviously, and you think conferences are really important because you and Barton put together that list of conferences. So I think it'd be helpful if we sort of switched gears to talk about like some in-person networking things, like what you might do if you're attending a conference. I had this really interesting conversation with, I mean, he's not a grad student anymore, but one of my classmates from grad school, Colin Weigel, and he told me that the first time he attended a conference, he thought it was like basically a massive substitute for reading papers. Like the point of it was just to attend a bunch of presentations and then like go to your hotel room or something. And obviously I think, you know, he knows different now and thought this would be a good topic for us to sort of discuss. So Anne, I'm curious, like your thoughts, like when you go to a conference.
Oh, hi Ava.
So Anne, I'm curious with your thoughts, when you go to a conference, particularly as a PhD student, are there particular strategies or something that you use to try to network?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess, so what I'm about to say is not exclusively like geared towards networking, but just like general strategies for attending conferences. I like to ask questions. So I usually like try to pay attention in the sessions that I go to and like try to ask a question at the end of, you know, if not every paper in the session, at least one or two of the papers in the session. And I find that that can like take a lot of focus. And so I won't, like the first few conferences I went to, I would try to go to a session like every single time that there was a session. So like 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. or however late it ran. But as I started going to more and more conferences, I realized that that can be kind of exhausting. And like, by the end, you just like can't focus.
You're fried. Your brain is fried. No.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then like you can't talk to people afterwards because like you can't form a coherent sentence.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, it's totally fine if you only want to go to a couple sessions a day. And then the other times, you know, either meet up with people for coffee or like take a long lunch. And I guess less when you're a grad student, but like when you're a like early career researcher, especially if you co-authored with a lot of like your grad student friends and now you're all scattered at different places, conferences can be a great time to like meet up with your co-authors in person. You know, just going in with the mindset that like people are for the most part, you know, friendly and like will want to talk to you. And sometimes they just like don't want to be the first mover, but like they respond very well to you being the first mover. So it's okay to, you know, go up to them and say like, hi, I'm Anne. You know, if you saw them present, you can say like, I really enjoy your presentation today. Or like, oh, I saw you in this session.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked what you said there. I think when I was a grad student, I had the same thing. I went to my first conference and I was just trying to attend everything because it costs money. And I was like, I need to like super take advantage of it. But then I noticed that I just got so tired and so drained. And I think this is where I always like to take use the concept of like active citizenship duty. So like, if you want to be an active citizen in a conference, you actually need to be like, your brain needs to be turned on and alert when a paper is being presented, which is gonna eventually mean that you can't attend every single paper. And so you have to pick and choose, and then see how you're going to use the rest of your time, whether you need to rest or whether you can start talking to people outside.
Yeah. And I think that buttresses well with this like idea of the question or topic of the day, like how do you take advantage of professional opportunities? And the reason I wanted to ask you that question, Anne, is because I just wanted to like reiterate, as we talked about here, like conferences are not just about a substitute for learning more information mm-hmm. yourself. They themselves are a really good opportunity to develop your professional network and learn and grow in all these different ways. And I think, you know, I was just like you guys when I first attended a conference too. Sort of attended and I was fried at the end of the day. But what I like to do now is try to think of like, what are things that I couldn't easily replicate or maybe couldn't replicate at all without this particular opportunity, right? So at a conference, it might be exactly as you said, Anne, just like getting together with three or four people and having a meal and talking. It might be talking with somebody that I wouldn't maybe be comfortable emailing or wouldn't have interactions with otherwise. It might be just attending like a networking hour and just seeing who I bump into. Those types of things don't really happen online, and it's, you know, these offline experiences that can sort of generate.
Yeah. And just to add, you know, to the kind of like substitute for like, just like attending a bunch of presentations and reading papers. A good way to find out about stuff that's going on like outside of normal conference hours is to look on Twitter. So especially at the bigger conferences like APAM and ASHIGON, people usually organize like social events and they'll tweet about them. So if you search the conference hashtag on Twitter, you can usually find out about like happy hours and things like that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, more broadly, even outside of conferences, there's lots of opportunities available to new researchers to sort of develop their network. So sometimes that is an in-person interaction, like a speaker is invited to your university. And I would definitely encourage graduate students and definitely new faculty to try to meet with and attend the talks of people, even if they're not in your department, for any sort of related mm-hmm. field, if they're coming to visit campus. And now that's a little more difficult because it's on Zoom and you might need to be on the listserv and you might just like not see a poster. But one thing that I do at the beginning of the year, I'm in the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, but I go on the economics department and the business school's website to see, well, who's coming this semester that might be of interest to me. And I try to go to a lot of their talks and have, you know, I email the people. I email the coordinator to see if I could maybe have dinner or lunch with the speaker.
And make sure you put those talks in your calendar, because sometimes you see them, you're like, oh, I'm interested in that. And then you totally forget. And that's happened to me. So then I have to like actively be like, on September 11th, this person is coming, you know, and we have to talk.
Yeah. And Sebastian, I'm curious for both of your perspectives. I found that graduate students typically are uncomfortable and really they don't want to meet with the speaker, but that faculty want the graduate students to meet with the speaker. I don't know what you both feel.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, I've only been to one grad school, so I don't know how cultures are different, which is good that we're all speaking to this. But I do feel that I think sometimes there's a speaker and you're like, well, I don't know what to talk with them about. And I don't have a good answer I believe I had that feeling. And the way I got over that feeling is that to keep just going and meeting them and then realizing that like these people are actually human beings and it's fine just having a regular conversation. It doesn't have to be about economics like 24/7. And I found it personally, like sometimes those conversations will be even more rewarding because I am building a relationship with that person rather than just like, you know, talking about paper, stuff like that. So maybe a tip there is just like, just do it and see, yeah, some of them are going to be really awkward and maybe you have to go through that process. Some of them are not, but, and what do you think about this?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. And I think it's a generic grad student thing as opposed to a department specific thing that a lot of grad students are kind of uncomfortable or nervous about meeting with speakers from seminars. And I think a lot of it stems from like grad students being nervous that the speaker will ask them about their research and then like think that it's bad or, right, you know, not interesting or something. Right. But you know, you really just,
and I still think that, by the way, like, I still have that fear.
Yeah. Most of the time, you know, the speaker is going to be a nice person and, you know, will probably be interested in your research. And if they're not going to be a jerk about it and say, like, I think that's the worst idea I've ever heard. Like, I don't think I've ever had anybody say that to me.
I wanted to say that, I think people understand that, you know, that you're at a stage where you're like working on ideas and papers. And so you can always, you know, sell it as like, yeah, I'm working on this idea. Maybe I'm not sure how to sell it or, you know, how to pitch it or what's the right pitch to do. Because I think working on a pitch of a paper, it's something that just takes so much work, and talking to people about that, could be a really nice way of like having a conversation to be like, I have this idea, but I'm not sure what is the right framework to make it super interesting. So I like what you said there about just talking, you know, like that fear of your research, that's right. You know, you're like, I don't know if this is a good idea, but just share it. And then you can work through making it a better idea in that conversation.
It's also possible that people do say something rude, even if it's accidental. And I think that is true, in and of itself, a good experience, right? Just to deal and learn with that, because it happens, right? And I think people are much nicer in economics in general than is maybe the reputation, but it's a real experience. And it's one, you know, I'm not saying you should have it, but it's...
No, I think that's a good point. I think that's important to mention. Like, yeah, not every interaction is going to be this beautiful interaction. And sometimes it's going to suck. And sometimes it might be even like ask you like, why are you even studying this? And then you say like, okay, bye. I'm going to eat my pizza and leave. I'm just kidding. I don't know. I mean, yes, I think that maybe will happen. And so just be careful and don't maybe talk to someone afterwards if you're feeling down about that experience.
Yeah, you got to have a vent friend after you have bad conversations.
So. Yeah, a vent friend for sure.
Okay, so as a last thing, I just, you know, most of our conversation today has focused on in-person networking or Zoom networking. But I just want to say, to build your professional network, don't be afraid to just email people if there's opportunities you want to learn more about. So for instance, I saw that Sebastian wrote for the AsheCon newsletter. I had a couple ideas. I had no idea how to get involved with that. And granted, I knew him a little bit, so I felt comfortable sending that email, but I just sent an email. I was like, hey, how do I get involved with this? Sebastian and David Slusky told me how to get involved with it, right? So don't be afraid. The worst case scenario, someone says, hey, no thanks, we don't want you involved with this.
Yeah, I think that's a good tip, because mostly the people who are also organizing these things, it's a lot helpful when you have more people that want to contribute to things. Otherwise, you're going to have to like go and look for people and ask, and then they rely on networks, and then we have another different problem, which is like, you know, they're just inviting a friend. So it's good to kind of like offer yourself up for those opportunities. Well, that's a great place to pause. But before we head out, we'd like to give our listeners a recommendation of the week. And what would you like to recommend to our listeners for this week?
Yeah, so it's not econ related, but I would recommend that if you're eligible, you make sure that you register to vote or are registered. And then if you can, go vote early, either in person or mail in your ballot as early as possible.
That's probably the best recommendation of the week we've had in this podcast so far.
That is great. So Sebastian, what's your recommendation? I'm gonna recommend
something, a small change that has been really useful, and I put it on Twitter this morning, which is control backspace erases words. And so I've been like deleting words by doing, you know, click 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 and deleting the word. And I did not know you can do control backspace or command backspace if you're on a Mac. You can also delete more words if you do control shift backspace, I think. But anyways, huge life changing. Like, it kind of takes a while to use it, to get used to it, but once you get used to it, it's a lot of fun. So that's my recommendation for the week. Alex, how about yours?
My recommendation of the week is somewhat similar to Sebastian's. It's not a keyboard stroke, like really helpful like that, but it's related to Stata. So I find that I do this all the time in my code. And whenever I co-author with people, they note that I do it. There could be a faster way to do this thing, but often I want to select a group of variables. And so there's this command that's really simple in Stata called ds. And what ds does is it lists all the variables and then it stores them as a local macro. But you can use the wildcards, and then you can do this in like multiple stages if you want. So you could be like ds a star. So that's all the variables that start with a. And you can also use inverse. So you could do like ds a star comma not. That's every variable that doesn't start with a. And so you could imagine doing this a couple different times, and you can really select quickly a group of variables, particularly if you named them thoughtfully. And then you can, right after that, access those variables in a local macro and do a loop or do all sorts of other tasks on those variables. And it saves a lot of time if you know that that command exists to sort of access things and then rename them or use them, do whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking I could use that for some of my outputting table things that I really wanted to do. So that's great. I like that. That's awesome. Well, that's all we have for you guys today. And if people want to find more about you, your research, your initiative, where can they go?
So you can go to my website, which is annmburton.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at @ann_m_burton.
That's it. That's all we have for you guys today. Remember to leave us a review. And if you want, you can write on the review which topics you would like us to cover. Remember that all the links will be in the show notes. You guys have a great week.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Ann.